This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate Gee. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every other Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Jen Hawk and Dr. Doug Lyle with the Beat Your Genes podcast. This week, we have just Dr. Lyle today, and then next week, we're going to have Dr. Hawk alone. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
Good. How about you, Nathan?
I'm doing great. So anything new in the world going on? I know this is not a current events episode, but we still love to hear your take on these things.
Yeah, I would say it's a disturbing and confusing time around the coronavirus, that it's very difficult to actually understand where we are with respect to this thing. So rather than just leave it there, I will say also that that certainly this current wave that we're experiencing now here in early August looks significant, but again, a significant notch down, a very significant notch down from where we were in January, February. So we're not sure all the reasons why. Some people might say vaccines. Some people might say a lot more herd immunity. Some people might say that the current variant is not as bad as the previous variant. We actually are not sure. Could be pieces of all three. Unfortunately, the science wasn't done properly to actually help us determine these types of things because the major safety trials were stopped after it was convenient enough to get emergency use authorization. So they refused to continue the appropriate data collection in order for us to actually see what the heck is happening. I don't think that that's an accident, by the way. However, we'll learn as we go. And we're hopeful. We're also extremely pleased by news out of Israel that it indicates that their next stage of a trial for this drug that has, or this actually a drug process that they have figured out that they are now running in Greece is having the very same stellar results that they had in their smaller trial in Israel earlier this year. So it appears that this brilliant group in Israel has in fact essentially checkmated the coronavirus. It looks like that is true. It looks like they have a simple, easy, extremely safe, no side effect way to drastically cut down the lethality of this disease. So we will see. I'm very extremely pleased with this, and they will do their stage three and final trial late this year in Israel, and they expect to have the results wrapped up by the end of the year. So that will be a game changer, provided if it turns out to be true, and they haven't published yet. They haven't told us what their control conditions have looked like, but the treatment conditions of the first 90 people in the treatment condition, 84 of them after 5 days are in great shape. So 93%, this is completely consistent with what they found in January, February, where they had 29 out of 30 people were in great condition in 5 days. And then the last person was fine after about 7 or 8 days. So we're going to find out what happens to the final six. We'll also find out what happens to the placebo controls that they have. And we'll take a look at this, and we will know, it will be known in 2 or 3 weeks. We will probably have a press release out of there that will tell us what has taken place. If it did it, which I think it did, because the mechanics of what it is that they describe make perfect sense, I think we've got it by the throat. And not only this problem may be solved, also what's extremely exciting for this group is that they believe that this very same technology may be extremely useful for a lot of devastating autoimmune diseases. And it makes sense to me that they may in fact have a tremendous solution. So just very basically, in general, when you have autoimmune processes and you have tremendous inflammation, et cetera, we'll go after those with steroids. We'll go after them with medications that will cause an overall depression of the immune function, which is, of course, extremely problematic. This is a way to go to the specific tissues that are being attacked and to do those in a graded fashion so that they use nanotechnology to actually deliver an agent that will essentially disturb that transmission and stop the autoimmune response. This is fantastic. And so the amount of medication, you're not having to take it systemically. In this case, they just breathe into the lung tissue that's being affected here. They just breathe the medication just to that tissue. So we don't have to go after the whole body, the whole immune system. We just go after that one little part of it. This is the spectacular results that they're seeing, and it has as the great doc over there says, this is a huge future in medicine. So anyway, that's that. I'm excited about that. Meanwhile, we watch the rest of the fireworks and hope that other general processes are actually starting to work their way to the good. All right. So that's enough update on that. Go ahead, Nathan.
That's exciting, Dr. Lyle. Yeah. I know I've talked to a couple of patients who are hesitant. They want to take the vaccine, but they're hesitant I've actually talked to a couple of patients who've been trying to do some fasting because they took the vaccine and it flared up their autoimmune disease, they believe.
Yes.
For whoever knows what reason, whether it was an ingredient in there or the actual vaccine itself, who knows, but... And then other people who have autoimmune disease are nervous about taking it for exactly the same reason. So
sure.
That's exciting that there's a different way.
I think it's already been solved, and I think the evidence is extremely compelling already. And hopefully we're not going to see, this is why this guy, they were pretty sure they had this thing solved last summer when they went to the animal models, but... unlike the whole vaccine process, this has not been rushed. This has been standard, extremely methodical science, and it looks like they will box our FDA and our NIH into not having anywhere to run with respect to this if it turns out to be as good as it looks. So I would expect that there would be tremendous pressure to have this available in the United States early next year under an emergency use authorization. We'll see. I will be fascinated to watch this. This will be being used, if it is as good as it looks, it will be being used worldwide by early next year. And so our agencies may protect the pharmaceutical industry if they are who I think everybody is. They may protect, foot drag, etc. We will find out if that happens. But it will not happen worldwide. There's no possible way that other countries will let the pharmaceutical industry get in the way of their people being saved. So the United States agencies face the embarrassment that they may be willing to tolerate of having Mexico suddenly... solving their problem very easily and cheaply with the solution coming from Israel while the U.S. continues to suffer. We'll find out.
And, maybe we'll start climbing over the border the other way.
There you go. There you go. We'll find out. I'm hopeful that there's enough sense on the U.S. government and that there's enough political pressure and enough moral pressure that if this solution is as good as it looks, that it will not be stopped. So we'll be learning an awful lot more about this in the weeks and the few months to come. I'm looking forward very much to the placebo control data that will come out, should come out in the next 2 or 3 weeks. I believe they've got it solved. And so that is a game changer for the landscape of the entire coronavirus crisis. And so that we'll be looking forward to how this all plays out. It's two different questions of the world. Can human beings solve the problem? And number two, will they use the solution? Those are two entirely different questions. And so to the fact that the solution may have been discovered is of enormous importance. The second part of it is interesting and important, but it is not the same level of question. So the most important question is, can human beings solve it? And it appears that they have. So we'll go from here.
Fantastic, Dr. Lau. We will be anxiously awaiting more news out of Israel there.
Very good.
All right.
All right. What else do we have?
Let's get to some questions because our genes really haven't changed too much since this last year. And the questions, I know our listeners, myself included, love hearing your logic as you wind out on these answers. And so our first question is, dear Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk, my 33-year-old daughter was recently informed by her therapist that self-esteem is created in the first 5 years of life. My daughter feels now that I failed her in this regard as I was her primary caregiver. She has had too many relationships with charming, G-cheating liars, quote, like her dad was for me. And she also flunked out of university and blames me, since I graduated with a master's, by the way. Essentially, she feels that her unhappy life is now my fault. My kids had a great upbringing in many, many ways by their two loving parents. We weren't perfect, of course, and I have some regrets about many things, but this assessment, I feel, is exceedingly myopic and unfair. Not to mention, it's devastating for me. Why do so many therapists focus so very much on upbringing and early life experiences versus genetics? Doesn't anyone practice what I would consider holistic psychology that incorporates evolution, genetics, personality, life experiences, etc.? I find it so frustrating that mom is just blamed when the adult child is unhappy with their life and the choices that they adamantly made in their teens.
Yeah. Interesting problem. So let's sort of break this down, and I will give you some direction about how it is that I would handle it. First of all, we know obviously the daughter's wrong, and so is the therapist. Self-esteem. We have to take a tip from Aristotle and say, okay, we have to define our terms. So the way I define self-esteem is going to be slightly different than the way someone else does. Actually, the general world uses the concept of self-esteem interchangeably with self-confidence. So they don't understand that there's actually a difference between the concept of self-confidence and self-esteem. The self-esteem is a dynamic process by which your internal audience observes your efforts and gives you essentially a moral vote about how admirable your efforts are. Okay, so self-esteem is really a feeling of your moral rightness, and that's basically what it is. And your feelings of moral rightness are highly dynamic. They're not fixed in any kind of stone. Neither is your self-confidence fixed in stone. So self-confidence is a completely different issue. It has a different tenor to it, which is that it's about your ability to compete in some competitive, adaptive social domain, whether it's mates, friends, or trading processes. So when the therapist says, well, your self-esteem is formed in the first 5 years of life, obviously your self-confidence is not formed in the first 5 years of your life. A great deal of what your self-confidence is going to be, in various domains is actually going to be determined by your standing vis-a-vis your competitors. And that standing may be fairly consistent across the lifespan as a result of your genetics. So if you're extremely attractive, intelligent, personable, emotionally stable, funny, etc., and you growing up in America with plenty of opportunity, your self-confidence is going to be very high. So your situation there is is not formed or formed by the first 5 years of life. It was actually, a lot of that is dictated at the moment of conception by gene variation. So the however, what we're interested in is the parts of these things that are variable. So your self-confidence and your self-esteem have day-to-day, month-to-month, week-to-week, period-to-period variance. And that variance is depending upon, in the case of your self-esteem, what has been the local or recent processes with respect to the moral rightness of your behavior. Did you do a really good job on your diet and exercise in the last week? Did you do a very good job at your work? Did you stay over a little extra and make sure you got everything done properly? If you did, then your self-esteem mechanism is going to be smiling. If you flaked out and did a lousy job, it's going to be frowning and it's going to have one eyebrow up. That is a dynamic process. It's supposed to be. It would have to work that way, just evolutionarily speaking. It would never fix itself at some point in time and then remain that way. That would be absurd. That would be like saying, well, you are either hot or cold or about right on your fifth birthday. If it turns out that you were in Los Angeles on your fifth birthday and then you moved to Alaska, you know, 2 months later, and then you're in the cold, it doesn't matter because at your fifth birthday, you actually felt fine temperature-wise. It's, of course, ridiculous.
Yeah.
Your sense of your circumstances vis-a-vis the environment cause changes in feelings that are inherently dynamic in order to guide your nervous system to optimal behavior. The same thing would be true of your, quote, self-confidence. So your self-confidence is going to be, think about a young boy who's, you know, a little boxing champion, and he's of his, you know, he's 8 years old, and he's beat up, you know, the other kids in this town that are 8 years old, and now they say, you know what? Given the fact that you're pretty advanced, we're going to put you in with 11-year-olds. Now he gets in with an 11-year-old, and now he gets pummeled. Now what's his confidence like? Okay, so obviously his confidence is dynamic. It is also true that your self-esteem is dynamic, even though those are different things. So so obviously the daughter is wrong, the therapist is wrong. This is a bunch of naivete, a bunch of parroting from very simple, you know, people that don't know anything. That's so fine. Now our questioner knows this, has been listening to us, and so is aware of this. And if you want to get it pounded down your throat, you read Plumman's book Blueprint, then there's no escape. Now, if your daughter has any brains, you could hand her that book, by the way, and say, and what I would say is, oh, by the way, your comments about this and your therapist's comments about this are actually incorrect. And here is a book that proves the point. Your therapist is undoubtedly not aware of this. And has not been educated in behavior genetics. And so I actually did a great job as a parent, and you know, it might be useful for you to get educated in this, okay, just for your own peace of mind. Okay, now, so this is what I would call sharp angle. Okay, so when someone accuses me of something that isn't true, I'll hit them back. Okay, it's like, no, you're wrong. Like, I have no problem telling people they're wrong. And so this person is a very nice person. Her daughter is essentially has some neural circuits shaped by her genetic code from somewhere that are sensitive to sniffing out advantages that come from complaining. Okay, people differ in this. There's genetic variation. Undoubtedly, I myself, you know, have complained now and then about this and that or the other, and that's because as a human, you're designed by nature to essentially call in chips of the insurance pool when it is that you feel like you've been treated unfairly. And so that's not something that doesn't have much close kinship in my family tree. Neither my sister nor either of my parents is a complainer, and we don't have a tendency to lean on that circuit in order to gain advantages in the world. That's just not something that we do. It's not something that, but people differ on that. There's going to be a bell curve of that. It's going to be associated with conscientiousness, and it's going to be associated with disagreeability. So highly disagreeable, low conscientious people are going to whine like crazy and bitch, and they're attempting to essentially use their energy in the bitching and complaining in order to try to gain resources. It's just as human beings evolved into insurance schemes known as a tribe or a group, they're going to have in there a lot of specialized circuitry that is involved in the adjudication of people making insurance claims. And so I came from a little localized gene pool of mine basically said, be self-responsible, don't be making claims unless you are in deep trouble and it is completely and utterly appropriate. And basically everybody in the village would probably agree with you that you've got some corn nuts coming to you. Okay. That's my family tree. That doesn't make us better people. It makes us good people with respect to being coalition members, because we're not real needy and we're not drawing on the county treasury very often. But it also makes us suckers. In other words, we're much more likely to be net tax producers to some village than we are net tax consumers. This girl is a net tax consumer. She's someone who is very much got her nose to the wind to try to figure out how she can get a bunch of resources by bitching. Okay, that's what it is. So it's neither good, bad, or indifferent. It's someone who, with that personality, that's the kind of personality that for me, I avoid that like the plague. When I hear that kind of entitlement, that person is, a line goes through their name in terms of any possible location that they would have in my coalition scheme. So this daughter, if this was my kid, and I heard that out of him, my attitude would be, you're now outside the guano ring. You just don't know it. In other words, don't count on me to be giving you any major help. You get to go fend for yourself. So this mother is kind of heartbroken and frustrated in some ways about this. And I would just tell you, you cannot control the daughter's process. This daughter has a big entitlement streak in there, been to therapy, been listening to the therapist, gets the news from the therapist about how we can blame it all on our parents. And then she goes home and blames her parents. Okay. So you're not going to be able to control that process. That is native to that individual, and that individual finds themselves in a sociocultural situation where that is being rewarded. Okay, now, so we can expect more of it. Now, the chance that you have for a relationship that has any meaning and any dignity and any value is to confront it. Okay. And this is why I would confront it. You know, you can use your own words and your own style, obviously, and it wouldn't be mine. It would probably be a lot gentler, you know, friendlier, nicer, more tentative. But if any kid of mine came to me with that, the answer would be, you're wrong. Okay, that is, you're actually mistaken. You don't understand. Your therapist is ignorant. And I actually did an outstanding job, and I provided for you as good of existence as any kid could have reasonably desired in terms of that. And no, if any problems that you're having now are derivative of the problems that you're having now or derivative of your natural genetics that I have really nothing to do with. So here's a book, if you want to get educated, by Robert Plumin, who is the godfather of behavioral genetics. And he, in this book, will checkmate all of the nonsense and just strip away all of the delusions that you're operating under. And if you, you can read it or not read it. It doesn't really matter to me. I hope that you do. But one thing that I'll let you know right up is that I did a great job. You're mistaken. And I have no culpability in your problems. Boom. Right between the eyes.
Wow.
Okay. So that's, and if it turns out that kid goes off and squawks to anybody who will listen about what a terrible mother she has, fine, whatever. Okay. I.e., the boat is leaving the shore. I am an extremely valuable coalition member, and I know it. Okay? And you can either swim for the boat, get educated, and trade straight up with me, value for value, because you're an adult. Okay? Or you won't. Okay? And if you don't, if you choose to try to dig resources out of the world through your complaining, you go right ahead. I don't really care. Okay? The only thing I care about is having relationships that are with people that are willing to trade value for value. And so, you know, I went through that with more than one of my, I effectively have four adult stepchildren, in quotes. These are very close connections to me. It's a family very close to me as a result of a romance from times past. And so these kids, I essentially supported them and raised them through their through their high school and early adulthood. And so they their father was not useful. Okay. And so therefore I stepped in and became essentially a father to four teenagers for a significant period of time. And in three of those cases, there was some turbulence, okay, at some point, where there was some essentially whining and frustration with me and my rules, etc., which incidentally were unbelievably liberal and easygoing and massively more than fair. No problem. They were 90-10 all the way, okay? But in each case, everybody, somewhere along the line, they'll, you know, they pushed the envelope or they had conflicts with me. And this is what they got. They got, no problem, you're wrong. Go. Here's a sack full of rubber bands. Go play with them and enjoy as much as you want, because I don't really care what you do. Okay? But the door's always open when you're reasonable. And you know what? In every case, they came back. Okay? So sometimes the odyssey took a little longer. Sometimes it was a little shorter. But after those kids had to go through periods of time where they found out that I, in fact, was extremely reasonable, and then it turns out that their bosses and professors and boyfriends and other things turned out to be a hell of a lot less reasonable than me. Okay, and then they had to go through a little adjustment, and then they find out, oh, that's how the world works. This is not unreasonable. This is what young people a lot of times have to go through. And so I have fabulous relationships with four out of four. The fourth one I never had a problem with. That one was inherently reasonable. Okay? And the other three were not particularly difficult, but they just had their difficult moments. So I trust that the solution to the problem is education. The solution to the problem is accuracy. Okay? The only problems that we can fix in the world, people, are questions of whether or not are we suffering because we are inaccurate. And in the case of this relationship with this mom and the child, the only thing that we can fix is the child's inaccuracy. And so if it turns out that we can't fix the inaccuracy for various and sundry reasons, the most logical one being that the child is a genetic whiner, and the child is going to sniff out that this is the best use of their time and energy is to figure out how to whine and bitch in order to lean on the mother or anybody else in sight who will listen, that they have been so terribly and poorly mistreated in their upbringing that they deserve a break. They deserve time off from their job. They deserve a disability check. They deserve this. They deserve that. And God forbid, they deserve mom ponying up more time, money, energy, apologies, and everything else under the sun. Okay, so the problem is that the daughter is mistaken, that there's an error, okay? And the solution to the problem is to correct the error. And so that's why we have, you know, and how do we know that it's an error? Because we know, because we've done the research, we actually have the evidence. And so now we hand them the evidence and we say, guess what? You're wrong, okay? Get educated or get lost, more or less. Because I don't need it. And so suddenly we essentially give them an opportunity to understand that they have to swim for the boat. And if they choose to not swim for the boat, that's fine. Okay. Then you move on and you earn esteem in the right way from people that matter. But that one, if that one doesn't swim for the boat at some point, we don't have to be nasty about it. You know, I'm not particularly nasty. It sounds nasty, but it's not that nasty. I don't have to raise my voice and yell and argue with anybody. It's just, no, it's not how it is. This is how it is. Okay. And this is, I was doing this before I understood what it was, and I called it sharp angle, and I didn't even know what I was doing. It took, you know, some serious analysis on the part of Jen Hawk to try to actually identify what the hell I was doing. But I told her when she talked about clinical problems, what would you do? And I said, I would sharp angle, and then I would describe this. Now I understand what it is. It's the cancellation of their insurance claim. Okay, it's just me saying, no, your coverage is denied. You do not get to make an insurance claim against me. Okay, boom. I take out a big stamp and stamp it no right in front of their face. Okay, and then they can do with it what they will. Okay, so in order to do that, you have to be in a position of power psychologically. You have to understand that. That's why, obviously, if it's your daughter and you're heavily invested in this, you're going to be more gentle than I would be. I don't know how gentle I would be with my own son if he came to me with something like that. Probably about like you're hearing in my voice right now. Be like, you know what? I don't need you. Okay? You need to swim for this boat. You are wrong. I'm a highly valuable member of your coalition. And if you are responsible with that value, we're going to have a very fine, productive, positive, loving relationship. If you accuse me of things of which I am not guilty and try to claim things that you do not deserve, the answer is no, and the coverage is denied. Okay, you have to earn my esteem in the same way that I have already earned yours. Okay, so that is what is fundamentally going on here. And that is a sharp angle is how it is that I would take it. The only way we fix a problem that can be fixed is to get educated. And so we educate the girl, and if she doesn't want to take the education, we educate her to the fact that educating herself in that way is the only way that she's going to get back in the coalition. Okay? So that's how I would do it.
Fabulous. Thank you so much, Dr.
All right, Nathan. Let's go on to the next
one. All right. Dear doctors, my source of distress is that I have a highly ambitious streak but can't seem to string together any consistent action since I've graduated university and settled into a job in a large firm. My worry is that perhaps I'm not very conscientious, as I have generally gotten by with straight A's in the UK's equivalent of AP examinations. I can honestly say I was probably at most working at an average of 60 to 70% diligence to achieve this. So perhaps I am high on intelligence. My concern is, am I doomed to mediocrity virtue of my lack of conscientiousness? What use would it be for me to have these feelings of missed opportunity, boredom at work, and the desire for more if I have a personality that checkmates all my efforts? Dr. Hawk suggested in a previous episode, without high conscientiousness, it is very unlikely one will be able to create any lasting habits or stick to the fundamentals. Is there anything I can do? Because as Dr. Lyle says, we can't change our nervous system. Am I doomed to live a life of what could have been?
Oh my God, that is absolutely priceless. The, well, I can tell you why right off the bat that I was never cursed with such a problem. And the reason I was never cursed with such a problem is I was desperately trying to qualify for girls that I couldn't qualify for. And so as a result, which remains true to this day. How do you think I wound up with four worthless stepchildren? So the point is that being the case, I always had pressure to try to make the most of my abilities to try to get every possible advertising angle that would give me every possible advantage in that competitive process. So that was just me, and that's not just me. That's every guy that ever swung a baseball bat or ever tried to win a math contest or anything else under the sun. Okay, a huge source of motivation to make the most of yourself is not to make the most of yourself. It's to compete in sexual competition. Now, if it turns out that our individual here, you know, maybe has good enough, plenty good enough looks that they have good enough feedback from the world, just kind of where it is that they are, and they're inherently not that conscientious and therefore not that ambitious, then yeah, you're doomed to mediocrity. Relative to what it is that you could have been, but that's probably pretty good wherever it is that you're sitting. To understand your behavior and anybody else's behavior, you have to understand that all your brain is a cost-benefit analytic engine. So you're just running a cost-benefit analysis on energy expenditures. And so if you're finding yourself saying, well, geez, you know what? I'm like really smart, and therefore I don't really have to work too hard to get plenty above average sort of pay grade processes. And so I'm just not going to work that hard. Fair enough. There's nothing in the world wrong with it. You may never trip over an avenue of possible action where you calculate that the effort expended might be really, really worth it. Now, the truth is the world is surrounded with opportunities like that. There's always differential opportunities coming up. There's always market inefficiencies in mating and trade and friendships. So there's always something that would be, quote, exciting. And excitement is the feeling that is derived from a good deal, i.e., it's essentially an energy efficiency computation on gene survival feedback mechanisms. Is that chick 10% hotter than one that I would otherwise feel like I would have a chance with? Well, if she just moved in next to you in chemistry class and is sharing, you know, the locker on the other side, you are so excited about going to chemistry. And suddenly it's like, oh my God, you're studying like crazy. And because you can't wait for the questions to come up, you're two chapters ahead so that you can say answers in class to make you look like a genius. Why are we putting out that energy? Because of the cost-benefit analysis. Okay, so essentially this person's talking about that they have a life of no excitement. And so, you know, and you can see problems with this with sort of maybe, you know, trust fund babies that have it all in terms of plenty of brains, plenty of social skill, plenty of good looks. And then pretty soon they're snorting cocaine because that type of thing, a supernormal stimuli, is the kind of thing that gives the genetically inlaid feedback systems a sense of excitement, like, wow, this is a really good deal per unit effort expended. We're getting a hell of a lot of dopamine in here for not very much effort. And not only that, we don't have to go work at the factory to get the money to buy the cocaine. We got plenty of it in our account. So this is where you can get wastrel behavior. So this questioner, you know, looks to me like someone who has it good enough in enough areas of life that they're not seeing opportunistic differentials between what's readily available to them and what they could get if they swung for the fences and really applied themselves. It just doesn't feel like it's worth it. And you know what? I actually saw kids like that going right alongside me in junior high school and high school. I wasn't really close to many people in college, but I did see it in junior high and high school. And boy, that, you know, I envied their sort of relaxed confidence and their sort of good looks and social suave and general coolness that they didn't feel any push to accomplish in the way that a lot of us did. And that's because they weren't feeling any kind of deprivation in confidence in these arenas. So, you know, the fabulous motivational speaker Jim Rohn summed up this issue. He said, you know, how big do your goals have to be? Big enough to turn you on. And that was very good intuition on his part. And I could break that down mathematically into what it really means. An opportunity needs to be assessed at such an excellent multiple of a rate of, you know, genetic rate of biological rate of return per unit of effort expended, that it signals the nervous system that that computation has taken place and drives a thing that we call excitement. Okay. So that's how you can tell the difference as to what your nervous system is calculating about, you know, prom date number one versus prom date number two. If prom date number one is a hell of a lot more exciting than prom date number two, there's a reason for it. Okay. If two houses that you're shopping for, one of them is just a hell of a lot more exciting than the other one, there's reasons for it. Excitement in your nervous system is derived from these, essentially the adaptive unconscious, computing the biological value of an opportunity. And this individual may, and the excitement is going to come when there's a very significant delta. Okay? So you can think of the tremendous excitement on the defining play of a Super Bowl. And it's like, okay, the excitement is you can feel the anxiety and the tension that if you win this thing, you get to swag into every bar for the rest of your life with a Super Bowl champion ring on your finger. You get to stamp to the world that on that day when we were assessed against the best in the world, our genes were judged as the superior genes by an objective analysis. Okay? That is unbelievably valuable to a human. And so as a result, you can expect that there's going to be great excitement and tension in that moment, tremendous drama. Okay? And if you lose, there's pretty significant devastation as a result of that. It's pretty damn depressing to have almost gotten there and then you didn't get there. Okay, so this person's question is really about, gee, my life doesn't have much excitement in it. Interesting. And that is what it is. My life has always been punctuated with excitement. There's always been evidence of opportunity and that risks and energy needs to be expended and that we got to take some chances and then we may have great gains. And then it turns out that, yeah, if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. But hey, that's what the playing field is here for, is to take advantage of such opportunities. But if you're someone who is inherently pretty comfortable and you inherently just don't have that much drive to improve your circumstances and your nervous system isn't reactive to modest levels of increase of the value of a situation, then it doesn't. Okay. And so, yeah, you've got it in you, but you maybe have to be trapped on a desert island with only one way out. And then it's going to be you and your brains against, you know, some great challenge. And then you're going to be excited. Okay. So, but you may never get there. So what can I tell you about that? Not much. Okay. So you could experiment by putting yourself in a situation that's not quite so easy. Not quite so sure, and has a lot greater upside. So, you know, if you've got plenty of brains and you got enough money in the bank or money behind you and everything's cool, but you're kind of bored, hey, join a startup company. You know, get yourself into a nice big mess, nice big risky mess with a bunch of people who are shooting for the stars and see what happens. I've known people that have done that and said, you know what, I would never do it any differently. After they've done it, it's like, why play carefully in this life when I have the opportunity to play that way? Okay. Other people have done a startup once and said, God, I'll never do that again. That's such a bunch of crazy stuff with a bunch of egos and crazy dreams and a big waste of time and all came to nothing and a bunch of vapor stock. And yeah, I wasn't paid too badly, but boy, we worked like crazy and it went nowhere. I'm not doing that again. Fine. Okay. All depends upon the individual differences in risk tolerance and what the needs are for that organism as it runs the CB against its life. So, yeah, I would certainly run an experiment on that, though. I would push yourself out into deeper water, see how it feels to have a bigger upside. obviously with the lowest downside that you can stand. But I would shoot for a bigger upside in some domain and see what happens. The incidentally, I had someone call me in the last month. Some very thoughtful, concerned individual really trying to figure out their life. And it was about a relationship, and the relationship on paper was so solid and so good, but it was flat as hell. Okay. And so it didn't matter the fact that the person checked a bunch of boxes objectively and was fine. The truth is that the insides of my collar were flat, flat, flat. And we talked about the person's history and whether or not they had ever felt differently. And the answer is absolutely they had felt differently. They had been in situations that were exhilarating and then heartbreaking. Okay? And so understanding that your nervous system is designed by nature to react very, very positively when its inferred delta, i.e. the difference of the upside, is high. That means it's in you to feel that. Had that person told me, no, I've never felt that, it'd be like, maybe you're a flatliner like our questioner here might be. But in this case, the answer was clear that that was not true. Person had an absolute normal dynamic of feeling. And that normal dynamic feeling in the current relationship was saying it's flat. It's good. It's, i.e., quote, good in quotes. There's nothing wrong with it. And my dad used to have a saying, yeah, there's nothing wrong with it, but there's nothing right with it either. And that's how you have to look at the concept of boredom, lack of excitement, lack of desire to essentially make the most of yourself in some domain. It's not because there's anything, quote, wrong with your situation. There's just nothing right with it. All right, Nathan. All right, do we have time for one more? How do you feel?
Yeah, let's do one more. Okay.
Let's do one more.
And this next question, okay, Dr. Lyle, is actually goes right into this question, this last question as well. So, dear Dr. Lyle, okay, you've spoken on previous episodes regarding running an experiment where you engage in doing an excellent job at work in order to engage your self-esteem mechanism, your internal audience, and then feel the pride that comes with doing a good job. This pride will supposedly allow you to get on a path of self-improvement at work, which, if done diligently, can open up new and more interesting opportunities that can go on to build self-confidence and ultimately interpersonal esteem. I could see how this process can be effective on turning off the feelings of frustration and missed opportunities that come with cruising and doing a mediocre job. However, in a previous episode, you also mentioned that boredom is a sign that you are not learning much at work and a signal for you to use your time more productively. How then does doing an excellent job and improving your self-esteem signals bear on tasks you find boring? I'm asking as a recent graduate who's early in their career. I'm in a junior role where most of my day-to-day consists of less interesting and boring support tasks, given that I don't have the skills and knowledge yet to engage in more interesting tasks and projects. So what advice do you have here? Can doing a good job in improving your self-esteem signals make these less interesting junior tasks that are the rite of passage as a junior employee feel less like drudgery? I feel like my problem is I know that better work is earned through acquiring rare and valuable skills in the marketplace. However, I struggle with consistently applying myself to the boring tasks that are needed to get there.
Yeah, it's very similar. It's a similar story to the question that we just answered, except maybe a little bit different, that this person actually can sniff a greater upside and would want to grow and apply themselves and compete at a higher level, but is now sort of stuck in a sort of by the organizational limits of what they can do. They're kind of stuck doing what they're doing for a while, whatever it is, stamping checks or entering data or whatever it is that they're doing. So I would have a number of things to say about that, and everybody's circumstances are going to be completely individual and different. Unfortunately, what is best for an organization is to a lot of times have people highly skilled at repetitive situations that they're way up the learning curve. So the transaction costs of getting something done are very low and they're very predictable. So that much better to pay somebody $22 an hour who's very bright and young to do the same thing over and over and over again for 3 years that they learned in the first week. Better to do that than to try to get it done cheaper for, you know, $15 an hour for people that flake out, move on. And so we're constantly having to have people climb the learning curves and it's a fiasco. So there's a lot of industries where that sort of takes place. And so people have a lot more intellectual capability and even curiosity than their job affords them to be able to satisfy. Now, so, you know, that is part of the rites of passage. Now, I could say, I would have a few things to say about that. And that is that one of the things that you're battling is you're battling the energy conservation system, because probably with extra effort, you can push your way into knowledge domains in that company that it might even cause a few people to be uncomfortable, probably not, but it might. But you can nose your way into things and ask questions and, you know, essentially find a way to become more competent. You also may not, one of the problems is it may not seem all that relevant. So you want to aim for things, you want to have a vague goal towards which you might be aiming in any career path. And so one of the things that you want to be doing is you want to be seeing about all the little nodes of knowledge that you can chisel your way into, sometimes by making a little bit of a pest at yourself, asking for additional assignments, etc. In other words, we go looking for the excitement of personal growth. Okay, so that's one thing that can be done. And you don't have to, essentially, burn the ships and say that this is my new way of behaving and I'm going to just completely go for broke here. But you can get more assertive in a work environment about asking for more responsibility, or certainly asking for direction about how to go about learning things or what might be useful to learn, and then going to the trouble of doing it. And that is that's an investment not only in the knowledge itself, but also in the reputation, that if you were to do this over a period of months, it gets noticed. It impacts people's thinking about how useful or competitive you might be in that arena, etc. So that's one thing. If you're getting stuck too long and you can see that, oh no, they don't promote anybody out of this, data entry stamping role for, it's like a miracle. There's 27 of us and they'll promote two of us, in the next 5 years to the next stage, then I would be looking to get out. Go to something that is far more dynamic. One thing that I read, not going to say it made a big impact on me, but I read a biography of Aristotle Onassis, and it was called, I think, An Extravagant Life. And I was struck by his boldness and his willingness to change direction, to go for different opportunities. In other words, Aristotle Onassis was not going to be denied. In other words, he was going to push and find a way. And so if you are seeking sort of more excitement and personal growth, you can find it. It's just a matter of how much energy that you are willing to put into it. And so and maybe it's not worth it because it takes your life out of balance. So I have to tell you, there's been times when I've been essentially overqualified for some job and I just cruised for a while. But usually when I was cruising for a while, I was busy doing something else, essentially moonlighting on another project. And that's what, I might have been somewhat bored at what it is that I was doing. But meanwhile, my mind was spinning out to the horizon, to the right or the left, on something different. Okay, so that's another thing that you can do to, if you are if you are struck, kind of stuck in a bureaucratic situation, and the most rational thing for you to do is to just keep your head down and smile and take direction and, you know, make a few little noises about extra things you could do or what it is that you should be learning. In other words, you're trying to learn the landscape, but it just doesn't feel that worth it to try to break your neck trying to shine in that situation, that there's simply a process by which this goes about and it's not that great, then fine. Then find something outside of that that has some excitement to it that you can invest in. And so this is where reading, you know, reading can widen your horizons greatly. And when I look on my bookshelves in my house, I can look back fondly at, you know, 45 years of serious reading. The very first serious book that I ever read that truly started to open my eyes was called Looking Out for Number One by Robert Ringer. And then from there, I found the libertarian philosophers, Ayn Rand, and ultimately Harry Brown. And then from there, you know, ultimately branched out into all kinds of other things. When I ran into Richard Dawkins at age 30, it's just sort of like looking at a tree of knowledge or a tree of life, that you could start to see all the other authors, et cetera. So there's never been a time when I haven't been pretty close to an important new book that I read and there expanded my horizons. So while you could be rubber stamping your way for a few months or maybe a few years through a hierarchical process, there's always something that you can do. Okay, there's always some place where you can find some excitement in your own personal development. So that's what I would tell you. And remember, also, be reasonable about the cost-benefit analysis, because it could be that the right thing is to leave that hierarchy and take, you know, and find a way out, to find something new. Another thing that I was willing to do in this life was to do things that were funny looking. In other words, I was willing to go and do things in places that seemed odd. So I worked for the criminal justice system in Dallas, coming out of after I left Stanford. I did something very different, and that actually came as a result of a tip that my sister gave me. My sister was an attorney, she's now retired, but she told me early in life. She said, "You know, Doug, almost no attorneys are always settling cases because they're terrified of going to court." And she says, nobody wants to go to court. And the reason they don't want to go to court is that they haven't had experience litigating. And she says, that's why one of the most valuable things that you can do if you're an attorney coming out of school is to go to work for the DA's office, you know, somewhere where you're actually going to handle real cases, or the public defenders, either way. Get in front of the judge, get in front of juries, and get your hands dirty. Okay, so that you actually do this. And she says, there's nothing like it. Because once you do that and you make a bunch of mistakes and you learn and you grow, and now if you go into civil litigation later in your career, where the fancy money is, you're not nearly as afraid of going to court because you've been bloodied and dirty. And so she told me, go get yourself bloody. I told her, you know, in my early 30s, gee, I just feel like I'm not ready for private practice. I got a fancy education, but I feel like I didn't say it this way, but I was wet behind the ears in life. And so we had that conversation. As a big sister, she said, go get dirty. Okay, so I did. And you know what? She was absolutely right. That was the best move I ever made, was to get down in the dirt and thereby learn a great deal more about clinical psychology than I ever would have learned in some counseling center at UCLA. So that's another thing that I would tell you. Don't be afraid to do something a little offbeat and different, because you never know what that might help you piece together in terms of your development over a longer trajectory. So that's another, yeah, don't be bored too long. As long as you can afford to not be bored, don't be.
Dr. Lyle, can we go two more hours?
All good. I hope some people find some value in this. It's just my thinking about these questions. I think these are really good, interesting questions, and there's a lot more to them than meets the eye.
Well, I certainly appreciate hearing your take on it. It's just amazing. So I learn something new every time I hear you wind out on an answer. And so, yeah, it's cool. A pleasure. So, okay, Dr. Lyle, thank you so much for doing a solo show today with us. We'll look forward to hearing Dr. Hawk next show for a solo show for her. And then we'll have both of you back. We'll have the trio again on the following show after that.
Fantastic. All right, Nathan.
Thanks for
having me.
If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.